note for the record that we're calling a case in re Processed Egg Products Antitrust Litigation. I'll ask counsel to put their appearances on the record, who they represent. We'll start with you, Mr. Levine.
Jay Levine on behalf of Roseacre Farms, and I will be presenting the position of the appellees today.
All right. Next, this is a little like the Hollywood Squares, if you've got it on gallery view the way I do. In the center square, I see Jan Levin, or at least that's the name, your nom de guerre. Can you identify yourself, please, and who you represent?
Yes, Your Honor. My name is Jan Levin, not related to Jay Levin. I represent, along with Ms. Sumner, United Egg Producers and United States Egg Marketers. And we cede our time to Mr. Levine.
Okay. I just note how eager she was to distance herself from any relation to you, Mr. Levine. But
I noticed too, Your Honor.
Although I feel very familiar after all of these years.
Yeah. Okay. Mr. Slater?
I represent the plaintiffs' appellants, Your Honor.
All right. Ms. Sumner, can you identify yourself for the record?
Yeah. Good morning. Robin Sumner with Troutman Pepper on behalf of United States Egg Marketers and United States Egg Producers.
All right. Thank you. Okay. Then we'll go ahead and call the case. Mr. Slater. I understand you're representing the appellants. You have the floor, sir. And do you want any time for rebuttal?
Yes. Could I reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal?
Yes, you may. Thanks.
Your Honor, in this case, the plaintiffs alleged a conspiracy to reduce the supply of eggs comprised of three component parts, or three sets of overt, if you will. And those component parts were the short-term measures, certified program, and the exports programs of the USEM. It is true that
I think it's fair to say that that we're familiar with the facts. So why don't you dive right into your legal positions?
Yeah, your argument, the question here is really, what could we allege? And we asserted that there was one overarching conspiracy. That's true. We simultaneously also asserted from the very beginning that any one or more of the three component parts of the program could constitute a standalone unlawful agreement. This was asserted from the very beginning in our amended complaints. And I'll use the Kruger
now
as a, excuse me.
I understand that. And I want you to respond, if you would, to the argument that's made by your opponents. That is, the district judge never said anything contrary to that, never said that every one of those things had to be proven to have been actually executed on. Only said that you had alleged a conspiracy consisting of those three separate mechanisms or schemes, and you got what you wanted. You alleged that overarching conspiracy, and when instructed, that was the overarching conspiracy that was described, and you got what you asked for, is essentially what they're saying. What's wrong with that assessment of the record, Mr. Slater?
It's not what we asked for, Your Honor. From the very beginning, from our complaints, we asserted two things. There was one conspiracy comprised of all three components, and any one or more of those three components could be a standalone unlawful agreement. We asserted that in the amended complaints. Again, find that at the appendix, page 707. where we said that the defendants participated and implemented the conspiracy by one or more of the following acts, and then listed three component pieces. In fact, in the amended very specifically argued or asserted that each one of the component pieces was a separate agreement. With regard to the short-term measures, that can be found at the appendix 710 to 711. With regard to the certified program, that allegation can be found at 711, 713, 715.
Yeah, I don't want to speak for my colleagues, but I promise you, you've given us ample citations. So is the other side. Citations which over and over and over again have your client through counsel saying, we're alleging a single overarching conspiracy consisting of these three things. I mean, that's all over the record, isn't it?
It is, as is the assertion.
Okay.
We are contending that any one or more of those could also be an unlawful agreement. As a matter of fact,
but you didn't allege an unlawful agreement consisting of one of or the other of those. You allege the conspiracy consisting of all three. Now, whether all three had to have been executed on is not something that the district judge said had to be found. On the contrary, go ahead, Mr. Slater.
I don't mean to disagree with Your Honor, but we did allege that each of the three component parts could be a standalone agreement. And if I may, Your Honor,
wait, stop. How can, like, just hold up.
Sure.
You told the court, and you told the court repeatedly, our case is a single conspiracy, a single overarching conspiracy consisting of three underlying mechanisms or schemes. That is what you told the court over and over again, right? I mean, I think we've established, well, we don't need to establish it here. I usually don't tell you what I think the record says, but I'm sure the record says that because you said
Your Honor, I'm not disagreeing with you. The record does say
okay.
That. The record also says that we asserted that any one or more of those three component parts could also be an unlawful agreement. If I might, Your Honor, a lot of this came up at the motion in limine stage in the lawsuit. The defendants asserted in three motions in limine that we were not entitled to go to trial on one overarching conspiracy comprised of all three pieces, that we could only go to trial on a single conspiracy with regard to the certified program. We pushed back. And we told the court, no, we're entitled to allege and go to trial on a single conspiracy comprised of all three. And in order for there to be no misunderstanding, my co-counsel, Mr. Blackman, stood up at the end of the argument and said, Your Honor, just so there is no misunderstanding, that we were also alleging a conspiracy formed and implemented, and I'll quote, by defendants and co-conspirators through one or more of three sets of overt acts or unlawful agreements.
Okay, I'm not sure, like there's this weird kind of ships passing in the night thing going on here, Mr. Slater. You're saying, wait, we really said this. And I'm saying, yeah, you really said that. So I'm not sure why you think the district court did you wrong. Because you said we have one conspiracy, a single overarching conspiracy, and there are three things that were going on. And any one of those three things, if they did it, supports the conspiracy. Now, can you show me where she said in the record anywhere, you have to find that all three things actually were acted on? Because when I look at this record, what I'm finding is she said there's a single overarching conspiracy consisting of three things, which you told Judge Prater again and again and again, and which you told the jury, and which was to your advantage to do because it allowed you to to get certain hearsay exception advantages because these were all part of a single overarching conspiracy. It allowed you to have advantages for how people might be held liable had there been a finding of conspiracy, whether they engaged in all three or only one. There were clear advantages for you in it. You took advantage of those things. Now show me in the record anywhere where she said, hey, jury, you have to find that they did all three things.
First of all, in the question of the verdict form, question one of the verdict form is stated in the conjunctive, not the disjunctive, as we repeatedly asked the court to do. And it states that the jury must find that there was a conspiracy to reduce the supply of eggs comprised of, and then it lists all three things, and it concludes with, and the United States egg marketers' exports. Stated in the conjunctive,
yeah, it requires. Right, but it says that's the definition. It says that's the definition of the conspiracy. That's the definition of the conspiracy, not what they had to say, not what they had to find in order to actually find liability. They didn't have to. Are we having confusion over whether what the nature of the conspiracy is?
No, I don't.
If what you're saying now is the nature of the conspiracy is different. We were allowed to allege an overarching conspiracy, and we were entitled to say, and if you don't like that overarching conspiracy, if we proved any one of these things and then ignore everything else we said because they're really three separate conspiracies, is that what you're arguing now?
Your Honor, question one of the requires, in order to find a conspiracy, that all three component parts be found. The full statement on question one is, do you unanimously find by a preponderance of the evidence that there was a conspiracy to reduce the supply of eggs comprised of, one, recommended short-term supply measures, two, the United Egg Producers UEP certified program as challenged, and three, the United States Egg Marketers USEM export. The court then gave instruction number 16, which states, and this is at appendix 3284 to 85, these three alleged restraints must all be part of a single conspiracy. The court told the jury that all three had to be proved in order for us to establish a conspiracy.
Well, that's where we just look. I was with you right to then, right up to that point, to the moment when you said, so the judge said to the jury, they had to find that all three acts occurred. Because I don't see where she said that. I see where she said exactly what you told her to say, which is, I have a single overarching conspiracy I'm alleging here, a single overarching conspiracy consisting of three things. And I'm going to take advantage of all the things that go with alleging that those are all part of a single conspiracy, which you did. Now,
Your Honor,
I've invited you to point it to me, and I'm not seeing it. I'm not seeing where she said, in order to prove that this conspiracy existed, you have to find that all three of those things actually were successfully accomplished.
These three alleged restraints, and restraints is referring to each one of the component parts, must all be part of a single conspiracy. If you and I
that's
just
true.
That differently, we do. To me, that says we have to prove all three. Furthermore,
okay.
Counsel, can I interject for just a moment? As I followed your argument in your briefs and here today, your response to Judge Jordan's question is, well, the verdict form is the court's statement that is erroneous because by using the phrase comprise, it required the jury to find all three of these acts in order to find antitrust liability, and one wouldn't suffice. And that's your response. Let's assume that's correct for just a moment. what I still don't understand is where there's error, because the court over and over says you don't actually have to do that. So it's possible that you could be right and say, well, taken in isolation, this verdict form using the phrase comprised and the conjunctive creates a problem. But that's not how we review jury instructions, is it? And over again, to Judge Jordan's point, the district court repeatedly tells the jury one or more will do it, not all three. So how do you reconcile that problem?
The only point at which the jury was told that one or more would suffice was in what we presented as a contention instruction. The judge told the jury, this is the plaintiff's contention. And the contention was that one or more of the three could suffice. That doesn't help us. That just hurts us more, because the court, in the court's instruction to the jury, then told the jury that our contention that one or more was sufficient was legally incorrect. And by giving the verdict form that the judge gave, told the jury again that what we were asserting was incorrect. The defendants in their brief argue that the contention instruction cures the problem. It doesn't cure the problem.
Wait. It's not just the contention instruction, Mr. Slater. The judge said, and I'm quoting now, it is also not necessary that all of the means or methods claimed by the plaintiffs were agreed upon by each individual defendant to carry out the alleged conspiracy, nor that all the means or methods that were agreed upon were actually used or put into operation. Close quote.
The fact that not all of them had to be put into operation doesn't cure the problem with what is the agreement. And the judge told the jury that all three of those had to be proved. It's pretty unequivocal.
Wait a second.
We differ on this point, but the judge told these three alleged restraints must all be part of a single conspiracy. That in conjunction.
Wait a second. Isn't that what you said? Didn't you say that is the conspiracy? Those three things, not any one of them, all three of the conspiracy. You said it again and again. The judge said it at the instruction and then went out of her way to say they don't have to have executed on all three. Any one of them would do it.
We did not say that all three must be part of a single conspiracy. We alleged that there was a single conspiracy with all three. Never.
Okay.
Never would we say that all three must be proved in order for there to be a conspiracy. To the contrary, we always asserted, and Mr. Blackman asserted it right at the time that the defendants raised in their brief, that in addition, we were also asserting that any one or more of them could constitute an unlawful agreement. And when the jury—
Just one last question from me. I got your argument. I think I understand your argument. One last question for me. You make your per se illegality argument, but would you agree that if we disagreed with you, if we looked at this and said, you know what, we're not persuaded that there was error in the jury instruction or in the verdict sheet, that your per se argument is moot because there was no conspiracy proven, done, right?
Absolutely. We agree with that. And I think we said as much. We included the per se argument because we think this matter should be retried, and we think it should be retried under a proper rule structure. That's why we asserted the per se claim.
Okay, understood. Judge Maney, anything further from you, sir?
No, not at this time.
Your Honor,
Judge Moran.
One very brief point,
and we've cited these cases to the court in our briefs, but in U.S. versus American Radiator, there was an allegation of one overarching conspiracy comprised of three different kinds of activities. At trial, the trial court declined to give an instruction that all three must be proved in order for there to be a conspiracy. This court affirmed and said the government was not required to prove all means and methods alleged. That's what we asked the court.
Thank you.
We don't.
Understood.
The Adamo case, which is cited in Gypsum, says the same thing, Your Honor.
All right, Mr. Slater, thanks. We'll have you for your rebuttal, 3 minutes of rebuttal. Mr. Levine.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, Jay Levine on behalf of Roseacre Farms. At the 11th hour, via jury instructions, the plaintiffs wanted to change the case from the one they had presented to the jury and had been prosecuting for 10 years in order to reduce their burden of proof. Having secured a number of benefits over the past 10 years, by the way they defined the conspiracy, the plaintiffs wanted to avoid the burden of that definition. It certainly was not an abuse of the district court's discretion to reject that attempt. There were two fundamental—
Why don't you go straight— Let me ask you, Mr. Levine, let me ask you to go straight to the point that Mr. Slater ended with. Talk about American Radiator. Talk about, you know, he's saying, look, this is contrary to the Third Circuit's own precedent, where it's been emphatic in saying you don't have to prove all three things, and it was wrong for the court here to say you had to.
Where the plaintiff's cases that they cite essentially say that, especially in a criminal indictment, when there are a number of overt acts alleged, you don't have to prove all the overt acts alleged in order to find the unlawful conspiracy. The difference here is, I think, as Your Honor actually pointed out, they have over and over and over again prosecuted a case that was a single conspiracy that included three different stratagems, to use Your Honor's phraseology from the class opinion. It had to include all three because of the next principle that they cite over and over again, which is that any company that engages in any one of the three is part and parcel of that same single overarching conspiracy. So in order for company A that did the short-term recommendations and company B who did the exports to be considered part and parcel of the same single conspiracy, that conspiracy must logically, inevitably include all components. And in fact, the district court was over and over again asking the plaintiffs, are you bringing a single conspiracy, or are you alleging that there are multiple conspiracies? And over again, the plaintiffs reiterated that it is a single conspiracy that includes all three. And in instruction 17, where the judge appropriately instructed the jury how they can find whether any given company joined and implemented the conspiracy, she correctly charged the jury that they need not find that any company did all three stratagems, one was sufficient. And that's exactly what the plaintiffs had been asking for. At no point did they ever ask and maintain that they were pursuing a case that was a single conspiracy based on just one of the strategies. In fact, Mr. Slater brought up the motion in limine. What had happened is that in response that the plaintiffs had brought motions in limine that focused only on the certified program as the problem in all of this, in all of the facts. And we brought a motion for clarification asking, are you now saying that there is a distinct conspiracy based just on the certified program, or are you maintaining your long-held view that the single conspiracy included all three? And counsel said specifically to the court that it included all three. And in fact, this very exchange that Your Honor had with Mr. Slater is an exchange that Judge Prater had with the lead trial counsel, Mr. Blackman. And Mr. Beckman said that our position is that a conspirator's joined or in participation in the conspiracy by participating in one or more. Then the judge said, but the conspiracy itself includes all three.
I got you, Mr. Levine. I've read it.
Okay.
Trust me, I've read it. So I want to take you back to American Radiator. I want you to address specifically Mr. Slater's argument that that was a statement and an emphatic statement by this court that if you're alleging multiple ways of executing on a single conspiracy, it's wrong to suggest that you have to prove all three of those means up. You have to prove them all up. I take that to be his pitch. Now, what's wrong in his argument and the way he's presenting American Radiator, if anything? Or is he right? And if he's right, does it throw into doubt Judge Prater's framing of instruction 16 and verdict question 1?
No, I do not think he's right, because what the court was saying there is, in finding whether the conspiracy itself was carried out, you do not need to find that all of the overt acts were carried out. But it did not say that if you are alleging a single overarching conspiracy, that not all of the components of that single overarching conspiracy need not be in the conspiracy. It does not say that at all. And in fact, American Radiator said, given the fact that the conspiracy itself was actually being inferred from the overt acts, they would actually have to prove the overt acts, because that's the only way you know that there is a conspiracy. But frankly, that's sort of almost irrelevant to this case, because it is this case where they kept maintaining that if Roseacre did just one of the three components, they are part and parcel of the same single conspiracy that Hickmans may have been in, who did something else. You cannot say that somebody who did one thing and somebody who did another thing are part and parcel of the same conspiracy unless those two stratagems are exactly coalesced and aggregated under the single conspiracy. And that's exactly what Judge Prater asked. She said, she made sure to make a distinction between the definition of the conspiracy and how anybody can maintain it. And in fact, at the charging conference, counsel for the plaintiffs said, we are not alleging anything other than the single conspiracy. But if somehow the jury can find their own conspiracy, we want to allow them to do that. And under those circumstances, given the fact that the plaintiffs had presented and had been litigating for years a single conspiracy, including all three stratagems, she declined their invitation. And in fact, that was the way the case was tried.
I think we got you. I think we got you on this. We've got just a few more minutes with you, and I want to move you on to your cross appeal, your contingent cross appeal, Mr. Levine. Unless I should ask Judge Mahey or Judge Horan, do you want to ask anything more about this central part of the appeal, Judge Mahey?
Nothing further.
Judge Horan, no. Okay. So let's talk about your cross appeal for a moment, Mr. Levine.
Okay.
Can you explain to me what authority you've got for a good faith exception to the Capra-Volstead Act? I'm a little at sea at where your authority for that is. In light of the decisions, so let me just put it to you this way: the Supreme Court Sunkist case, for example, says, you got one non-producer, you're done, you're out. What's your response to that?
All of the cases, Sunkist, National Broiler, and all of the cases cited by the plaintiffs go to whether the Capra-Volstead immunity applies in a given case, especially if the cooperative includes a non-producer. We're taking as a premise that the Capra-Volstead immunity does not actually apply per Judge Prater's ruling. But what we're saying is that there is inherently a good faith defense that if a producer has a good faith belief that his cooperative is immune under Capra-Volstead, because it is impossible to police a 14,000 member cooperative.
I know that's your argument. I'm trying to ask you, what case do you have? What authority do you have that any such thing exists?
There is no case directly holding the existence of a good faith defense in the Capra-Volstead context. However, both the exemption for agriculture and the exemption for labor are born from a single mother, if you will, from Section 6 of the Clayton Act. They are both, they derive from there. And this court has specifically recognized, and the Supreme Court has, that there is something called the non-statutory labor exemption, that essentially there is a good faith defense in the labor context, if even though the exemption, the statutory exemption may not apply. And we're arguing by dint of logic and necessity that that same sort of exemption should be carried over into the agricultural context.
Isn't it sort of a fundamental a statement of antitrust law that exemptions are to be narrowly construed? That, you know, you got the Capra-Volstead Act, it gives an exemption from ordinary restrictions or prohibitions on horizontal restraints. Now, speak to that. I mean, I thought an interpretive rule was, if there's going to be an exemption like the one Capra-Volstead gives you, it's got to be narrowly construed. Isn't that true?
The exemptions generally for antitrust immunity are generally to be narrowly construed. But in many
how can we start making up good faith exceptions? Because that doesn't seem to square with narrow construction.
This court did exactly that in Consolidated Express and reconfirmed in Feather v. United Mine Workers, when it specifically held that there was a non-statutory labor exemption. In other words, and in insurance and in other industries that we cite in our brief, there are instances in which the judiciary has realized that there is an implied exemption, notwithstanding the rule against expanding exemptions, if you will. Nevertheless, these implied defenses have been recognized, and we are suggesting that there is actually no reason why a good faith defense in the agricultural context should not be applied when it is in its sister context in the labor, and in fact would go to promote the very policy that is embodied in the Capra-Volstead Act, which is to promote cooperatives and their membership. And in fact, that policy is reconfirmed every year.
Yeah. I got your policy argument. Just a couple minutes we got left here, I do want to ask you about your sort of we should win as a matter of law argument, and particular the Matsushita argument that you're making. That sort of depends, does it not, on a case being made solely on circumstantial evidence. That's where Matsushita comes in, correct?
That is correct. If the case is built on direct evidence, Matsushita does not apply.
Okay. That being the case, work with me here isn't there direct evidence here from which the jury could have? The jury didn't think there was a conspiracy, apparently, but there was direct evidence where there were statements like from your client's executive, I don't really know what this whole motive is, but I think there is more to it than animal welfare. I think some people think it will make them rich or something. Or from the UEP executive, we have tried to downplay exports and animal welfare as reasons for improved prices. This is our statement to the media type. In reality, egg producers are enjoying good times. Don't those statements amount to direct evidence that, hey, we're saying all the stuff PETA wants to hear, but this is really about lining our pockets? That's direct evidence. No?
No, I don't believe so. Direct evidence, this court has said, is explicit and requires no inferences to establish the proposition or conclusion. A I don't know what this is about or some other party statement certainly isn't a direct evidence that Roseacre consciously and knowingly participated in a conspiracy to reduce supply. And in fact, the district court below on at this issue on summary judgment basically had said that there is direct evidence only of participation in a certified program, but that the certified program itself is not direct evidence of the alleged conspiracy, and hence it's circumstantial, which brings into the Matsushita's tend to exclude standard.
All right. I'll ask Judge Mady and Judge Ram one more time if they've got any additional questions.
Do not.
I'm seeing head shake and no. All right. Thank you, Mr. Levine. Mr. Slater, you have 3 minutes for rebuttal, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. Three quick points. First, Mr. Levine said that we were trying to hold Roseacre liable, even if we had not participated in the individual conspiracy, which we allege should have been put to the jury. That's incorrect. We submitted a verdict form to the court, Appendix 1506. In that verdict form, the first question asked, is there a per se violation? Now, I understand the debate about per se. The second question asked, is there a rule of reason violation? The third question specifically asked, do you find that each of the three defendants participated in the conspiracy you found in answering question one or two? In other words, the conspiracy you found unlawful. Only if they checked yes next to that defendant's name was that defendant going to be held liable for participating in the conspiracy found. Second point, it's not just American Radiator, Your Honor. And at the risk of looking foolish for telling Your Honor what Your Honor said in the opinion you wrote in the class case, in that case, the defendants argue, contrary to what they say here, that each of the three component parts had to be analyzed separately to determine whether the conduct is per se unlawful. You can't analyze conduct as per se or not unless there is an agreement to engage in the conduct alleged to be per se unlawful. Your Honor.
Wait, hold on just a minute. Hold on just a second, Mr. Slater.
Sure.
The fact that that separate stratagems might conceivably warrant a different analytical construct, that is rule of reason versus per se, that doesn't say anything, does it, about the character of the conspiracy that was alleged and sought to be proven, does it? I mean, it just says if they're component parts, they may not all properly be analyzed with the same tools.
In the class opinion, the court states that the method in which the plaintiff characterizes the conspiracy does not control. And the court then stated, courts consider the differing components of the alleged conspiracy separately. Now, the court was speaking to the per se rule, but I don't believe you can speak to a per se, unlawful agreement unless you have an agreement to engage in the conduct purportedly per se unlawful. So when the court says that each of those components has to be analyzed separately, I believe that would cover the question of is there a conspiracy, as well as covering the question of is it per se. And again, I apologize, Your Honor, if I'm purporting to tell you what you wrote.
People tell me that all the time, Mr. Slater. It's okay.
Very quickly, with regard to the third point, is there direct evidence of a conspiracy with regard to the defendant's contention that this should be disposed of as a matter of law? The defendants admit in their briefs that there was a written signed agreement between horizontal competitors who were the members of the UEP and Roseacre to all adhere to the rules of the certified program. That's an agreement. Question is, did the agreement have an anti-competitive effect? but I can't imagine any more direct evidence of agreement than a signed written agreement. The export program was also a signed written commitment to undertake the export, and that was a commitment signed by multiple horizontal competitors. Again, there could be no more direct evidence obviating the need to engage in the Matsushita analysis than written signed agreements by horizontal competitors. Your Honor, I believe that's all I have, unless there are further questions.
Right. No, and we thank you for argument today, Mr. Slater, Mr. Levine. Thank Ms. Levine and Mr. Sumner for Ms. Sumner for presence here today. We've got the matter under advisement. Thank you again for briefing and for appearance. And we'll go ahead and recess court.